want to welcome everybody to the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary. We're appreciative of you being here today. We think that we're hearing from several of our members who are traveling here that they will be here, but they're just running a little behind schedule. I understand that Senator Duncan, you and Senator Burdick have a meeting that you'll be going back and forth between today, so we appreciate your willingness to work with that schedule. We have a full agenda today, and we'll try to move through it as quickly as possible, and we'll get going right away, but I want to obviously give Chairman Minnis the opportunity to comment on anything you want to comment on before we start, if you've got any opening remarks. Otherwise, we'll just kick off.
I really don't, although I was kind of hoping the media would show up on the methamphetamine discussion this afternoon. Send that out and see if there are any media people. It's an issue that I think ought to be paid more attention to. There seems to be a proliferation of this kind of activity, not just in the Portland metro area, but statewide, too, and it is growing. So other than that, I'm waiting with bated breath to hear from the agency.
Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead then and start with our first panel. We appreciate the folks from Department of Human Services and being here today. So if you want to come forward, our first panel, Director Mink, Ramona Foley, and Bill Fink.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Mink. I'm the Director of the Department of Human Services, and with me on my left is Bill Fink, who runs our field systems. And on my right is Ramona Foley. You got the chair with a low seat, Ramona.
Yeah, I noticed.
who is our child.
You just match yeah. the chair.
You want to trade?
Why don't we?
With the Child Welfare Policy Office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know that feeling about low chairs.
There we go. Keep you humble. Right.
We were asked to come here today and give you a summary of some corrections that we've made to the child welfare system prior to the case in Clackamas County. And I would just like to say a few general things about child welfare before we get into that. And I know most of you all know this, but I just need to say a couple of things. The child welfare system, both nationally and in Oregon, is responsible for kids who have been abused and neglected. And the premise for those systems is that the parents of a child and the people who are in custody of a child, an extended family of a child, will protect them and nurture them. And when those things break down, the child welfare system then is responsible for assuring safety and health of the child and to stop the abuse and neglect, and to work with families to improve the way they deal with their children, and as soon as we can to find permanency for a child, either back with the natural family or an adoptive family, if the natural family proves to be unable to make the corrections they need to do to keep the child healthy and safe. In the Clackamas County case, the first part of the system broke down, and there were allegations of abuse and neglect of these girls. And notably, in the Clackamas County case, the one that we looked at was Ashley Pond. In the case, when it breaks down such as that, the child welfare system that the state runs works in cooperation with local law enforcement and local district attorney and other partners identified by the multidisciplinary team to determine how to handle those cases. And we have a certain set of responsibilities that we need to do in that case. The district attorney and the law enforcement, depending on the type of case, have certain responsibilities. In the Clackamas County case, the responsibilities that the public holds us to and that you hold us to by state law, we failed. And we failed for a number of reasons. We had staff who didn't do the things that we had in policy, and I'm sad to say that some of our policy didn't conform with state law. And I asked for a complete review of the situation, and a member of our team, Tony Peterson, headed up a broad group that went in and looked at what we did in Clackamas County and didn't do in Clackamas County, and came back with the infamous 13-page report you all heard about in the news media, and with several recommendations about findings about what went wrong in Clackamas County, and then recommendations about how we can improve it. And we did all of that. We made those improvements, and we're still working to make it as best we can. And Ramona and Bill will talk to you specifically about those improvements. The concern that the additional concern I had, and Ramona and Bill had about this, was that if we had some policies that weren't perfect, and some systems in Clackamas County that weren't perfect, then in what other areas of the state could there be some things missing? And as a result of the findings in the Clackamas County branch, I ordered two other reviews, actually three other reviews. The first, I asked each one of our field managers to do a self-assessment of the child welfare offices for which they're responsible, and make sure that the things that happened in Clackamas County would not happen in their area. The second thing we did is, one of the findings in the Clackamas County case was that the front end of our system, when we get a call and we do the screening and the referral to law enforcement, was flawed. I've asked two people from outside our agency, a person from the Department of Administrative Services, and then a contractor who has done some child welfare work in other states, to take a look at that front end of our system around referrals and screenings and what happens with that, to see if there are some systems improvements that they can recommend to us. I wanted to have a third-party look at this. We get so close to it sometimes that maybe we don't see everything we should see, so we're having a third-party look at that. And then the third part of that is that we're doing an in-depth management review of four of the branches in the child welfare system. One of the things I feel strongly about our department and in child welfare as well is I think by and large we have very, very good staff. Sometimes we have staff that don't do the right things and we deal with those things, but by and large we have pretty good staff. But sometimes we find out in these cases that the systems are less than perfect. The systems that we have in place are less than perfect. And I want to make sure that we have systems in place. The other thing that we found in Clackamas County is, even with a system that wasn't perfect in Clackamas County, we had a management team there that wasn't demanding that the staff follow policy. We were lax in our management, and that concerns me greatly. And so the in-depth review of these four branches about management will get into what our employees' responsibilities are, what kind of expectations we're setting for them as managers, whether or not we're holding them to policy, and the like, things like that. And the branches that we're looking at in that regard are, let's see if I can remember them, Jackson, Coos, Baker, and Lane. Tried to get a big branch in Lane, tried to get an Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon branch, to take a look at from those four branches, where we're weak in management systems and also management practices by our employees. These three reviews that I've asked for will be back to me in the middle of November. I'd love to come back and talk to you about what we find. And we will implement, we will start an aggressive improvement plan around child welfare practice, both correcting policies that we think can be improved and also correcting our practices, and also doing something about our management of the system to assure that our managers are holding our employees to what we say we're going to hold them to, both in state law and rule. The other thing that will, I hope will come out of this, is to be able to come back to you and make recommendations about some things that are unclear to us in the law. And one of those, let me give you an example, is unclear right now as a result of the Clackamas branch review. State statute requires us to do an immediate referral of all reports of abuse and neglect to law enforcement. We weren't doing that in Clackamas. We were doing a triage, and then we were sending things on to law enforcement as we felt was appropriate. And we were doing that within the context of the multidisciplinary team agreement. But clearly that wasn't following statute. And I've ordered that we're going to comply with statute, so we have a temporary rule right now that requires our staff to, when they get a referral in, to make a call in to make a referral to law enforcement. And the feedback I'm getting from law enforcement is that's overburdening them. I think we need a definition around what immediate is.
Mr. Mink?
Yes.
Don't believe everything you hear from law enforcement.
Mr. Chair?
I'm going to interrupt you here, and I'll let you continue. Yep. But some of us were here back in the late 80s and through the 90s in the creation of the multidisciplinary team laws. Senator Joyce Cohen, back in 1989, originally introduced the legislation. Senator Peter Courtney and I both sat in this room as members of the House of Representatives, putting together and designing this system. And in 1993, when I co-chaired Ways and Means, I had a meeting with law enforcement over the issue of whether or not they would or would not investigate child sexual abuse or physical abuse investigation. In 1993, we compelled them to do it. We demanded that we do that. We demanded that law enforcement investigate criminal events involving children, and that we no longer refer events that are criminal to your agency, where you have people who do not have the expertise to do. That doesn't take away from your folks and their intent, but the idea was that you give it to the agency to have the expertise responsibility. And the question I have for you is, where are the DAs in this discussion? So, you know, that was the biggest problem we had in the creation of multidisciplinary teams. It wasn't until we created the CAMI funds in 1993 that we drug the DAs into this whole discussion, and they were kicking and screaming. It wasn't until we put money in the program until they got off their duffs and started doing something about it and creating multidisciplinary teams that actually did something. So where are the DAs and where is law enforcement in this entire discussion? Now, you know, I understand what you're saying about your management practice. I understand what you're saying about your folks. But law enforcement bears a large bulk of responsibility for not responding, for not being involved in the development of the multidisciplinary team protocols that would have allowed them to review all of those referrals up front. And having served four and a half years in the Multnomah County Child Abuse Team, where they're housed, co-housed together, and there's a dynamic where you walk across the hallway and talk to SCF, yep. You talk to the hotline across the hall from each other, you talk to the district attorney, and they have the child fatality review teams, yep. And they have the various meetings for the MDT on a regular basis. That is the dynamic that was envisioned in 1989 when Joyce Cohen first sponsored that legislation, and in 1993 when we created the CAMI funds, and when we set aside $600,000 in the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training just to do training for law enforcement so they would be able to do these investigations in the first place, because that was their major complaint. If you give us this responsibility, oh, it's going to overburden us. Oh, we can't do this because we don't have the expertise. We can't do it because we're not trained. Well, we gave them the training money. And they've set up and they've joined themselves with the SCARS Conference, Jasper Mountain, and Eugene once a year. They've sent people all over the world or all over the country identifying the best training experts in this nation on child abuse issues. So they've got no excuse. And, you know, I find myself defending you to some degree here, but I think law enforcement should be sitting here, the DAs should be sitting here, and they should all be answering, because the DAs are the ones that we set up in statute to head the MDT. They're the ones that are supposed to be the political leadership of the multidisciplinary team. They're the ones that have the legal expertise to help develop protocols that will not endanger children.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, the question about where the DAs are and where the law enforcement is on this, I think, is a good question. And the governor asked each of the MDTs to do a review of their protocols after that case, and all the MDTs are working on that as we speak. I have not seen the results, however. These cases are very complicated, and I think the issue around immediacy and what we refer, everything you said is right on, is though, did the legislature mean some of these things around head lice referrals and neglect referrals also to go to law enforcement? If they did, then our temporary rule is right on. If you didn't intend that, then when we file a final rule, we need to know that.
Mr. Mink, just for clarification, my recollection is that it was supposed to be a dialogue, that there was supposed to be a conversation ongoing and a continuing conversation between the various partners in the MDT, and that's why the DA was given the primary responsibility, because they're the ones that are going to make the decision to prosecute or not prosecute, and whether or not head lice or any other form of physical abuse or medical non-treatment, whatever you want to call it, rises to the level of a potential criminal prosecution. That's why they're supposed to be involved.
Right.
So, yes, that dialogue is supposed to be happening in every county, all 36 counties in the state.
Well, I can tell you, Mr. Co-Chair, that the MDTs had protocols set up. Most of the protocols do not include protocols around third-party abuse. That was not considered separately. And the protocols, many of the protocols also required us to do a triage before we sent it to law enforcement because of workload issues. And that's not according to state laws that exist today. So we need an examination of what current practice is, not only by our agency, but by the district attorneys and law enforcement statewide before we get a clear picture of what child welfare practice is. Because one of the things I said in the news conference is that once a family fails a child and there's an allegation of abuse and neglect and we have to get involved, we're one part of a three- or four-legged stool. We have the DAs and law enforcement and other community partners to be involved in that. We need to look at the strengths and weaknesses of all parts of it. Now, we're aggressively looking at the part of it that for which we're responsible, and we're finding that we're less than perfect. But we also need to look at the rest of it, as you say.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm not particularly tuned in on this, but I'm curious, and I see this in reviewing the report, and I've heard you mention it now a couple of times as well. Why would you have a separate protocol for what you refer to as third-party child abuse? If the issue is child protection, does it matter in terms of your protocols where that's coming from?
Mr. Chair and Representative Shirley, I think that the only importance may be is just to make sure that people understand it's not familial when you make the referral. And the other presumption is that if it is third party, the primary people who are going to be responsible for the investigation would be law enforcement and the district attorney, although there's also sometimes a role for our department as well. So I think that I'd like to have Ramona weigh in on this, who's our child welfare expert about those matters.
No?
Yes, please.
Okay. Mr. Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm an assistant director at DHS, and I'm over an area called Children, Adults, and Families. In response to that, the law in Child Protective Services, the state laws contemplate that when the state intervenes, there's a relationship between the child and the parent or the caretaker of the child. It could be a foster parent. But that relationship yields itself to some type of a treatment plan. So when we intervene and it's a family, and even if there's substantiated abuse and neglect, we have the ability by law to set up a safety plan for the child and work with those parents. One of the things that's different about third-party abuse is the relationship is different with the child. Third-party abuse can include things like someone who is operating a daycare center or someone who is a Boy Scout leader. There's some other, perhaps, physical contact with the child, but the relationship is outside the bounds of being in the parent or in loco parentis relationship. Many states have laws that separate these two at the portal of entry. Many laws will say that if it is third-party abuse, it is reported directly to law enforcement with reciprocity of law enforcement to let child welfare know, for example, if there's a child who may also be at risk in that family. And at the same time, then what comes to the Child Protective Services door would be those things where the report is that this is in relationship to the abuse and neglect by a parent or a person who's caretaking for the child. So Oregon's law is a little bit different in that it is the reporting goes to both. The reciprocity is required in all of these cases in Oregon law.
Mr.
Chair?
Yes. I appreciate that. I guess I maybe comment for Senator Minnis, but it sounds to me like this is at odds with the objective you were talking about, getting investigation of abuse to law enforcement where they're trained and have the resources to do a criminal investigation, because whether it's family or whether it's non-family, it's still criminal abuse.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how this different treatment at the agency level is meeting the objective that Senator Minnis was just talking about in setting this whole system up. I mean, for instance, I'm a lawyer, I'm a mandatory reporter. I'm not, you know, in my case, if I have suspicion to believe there's abuse, I'm not going to distinguish between family or third-party abuse. My report goes because I'm required to report abuse, and I don't take into account where it comes from. And it seems to me where we're talking about a criminal act, whether it's family or non-family, the protocol ought to be the same, shouldn't it?
Well, at least in practice, I mean, I understand the discussion that Ms. Foley just raised, but In Multnomah County, there's one number for the child abuse hotline. And so citizens, when they think, I've got a child abuse issue, if they're thumbing through the phone book, they think maybe it doesn't rise to the level of a 911 emergency call, they find the child abuse hotline, they call that number. So to that extent, they're really getting themselves, at that point, they're accessing the multidisciplinary team. The multidisciplinary team component members are law enforcement, schools, the district attorneys, state child welfare agencies, and there are some other members there. But I guess the idea was that at that point it would be triaged, because that team is supposed to be working together. In other words, you're literally, hopefully, reporting to law enforcement at the same time you're reporting to SCF. And that's somewhere in there is where we're breaking down. So.
And Mr. Chairs and Representative Shetterly, these things don't have to be exclusive of each other. In some states, most states now have multidisciplinary teams, and they sort out how this kind of reciprocity happens. But it does allow them the ability to say very clearly, and perhaps even through the law, if there's a criminal investigation, that will take a precedent and for the law enforcement to be involved, whereas if it's apparent and there's no indication of criminal wrongdoing, then that relationship would first be dealt with by Child Protective Services. So all I'm doing is drawing the distinction that there is difference across the country in terms of how those laws contemplate third-party abuse.
Mr. Chairman, for the purpose of Oregon, the idea there was that there would be this multidisciplinary team where all of these participants would be together, and that's where it would be triaged. And at that point, during the course of that discussion, they would say, it really is not child welfare. We really need to refer this to law enforcement, DAs, this is your, and it goes on. But we're breaking down there because, my experience in the child abuse team in Multnomah County is I know that when SCF would receive calls through the hotline, they would fill out a form. I don't remember the name of the form. And sometimes our supervisors would see those forms immediately, and sometimes they'd see them 2 and 3 weeks later. And our supervisors would go through those forms. And occasionally they'd walk back over and say, this thing should have been referred to law enforcement. Why isn't it? Or occasionally we'd have an SCF worker who was out investigating their own criminal case as if they were a criminal investigator. And we would go back and say, no, you don't do that. You just messed up our search. You've taken away our probable cause, or you've eliminated our ability to do a pretext phone call or whatever it is that we were going to use. But we're breaking down this whole dialogue and triaging thing. It's not as if SCF stands alone.
Right.
And law enforcement stands alone, and schools stand alone, and the DAs stand alone. It's supposed to be a dialogue, an ongoing dynamic.
I want to make sure that the panel and that the director have an opportunity to make the points they want to make and to keep us relatively on schedule. But I think this is an important issue. And just from my personal view, one of the questions I'd like you to maybe address before you're done in your comments is how much resource issues have affected this. I mean, as I look at this, I look at the number of calls, I look at the clerical delay from getting the system updated, I noted the almost 4 or 5 months before the review of the handling of the file was approved by the supervisor and entered into the computer system. So at some point in your remarks, I'd like you to address caseload issues, and to the extent that you think those things played a part in the breakdown here, I'd like to know what you think that was.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can give you an opinion about that. My personal opinion is that while we can always use more resources in child welfare, we're never going to get what we think is adequate. And so we've got to use our resources smarter than we're using them, and we got to make sure that those policies we have in place, as an example, doing a screening within 5 days happens. And right now we have in place a policy in which our supervisors need to review the screening work within 3 days. From time to time, though, vacancy factors and a lot of other things come into play in these branches, and particularly recently as we've had these hiring freezes, so that we can be short. But we need to make sure, and the only way I'm going to be able to answer your question more definitively is to go through and take a look at our management practices and our workloads branch by branch. I'm convinced that we can do a better job with the resources we have if we do a better job of managing our priorities and managing our staff time. And I think that was lacking in Clackamas, and I think it may be lacking in some other parts of the state. But I think Ramona can tell you a little bit about what our staffing standards are in Oregon as they compare to other parts of the country. That doesn't mean that everything's the same from Oregon to other parts of the country. We can kind of give you a feel for what these national standards are, who've been developed by people who've been working in child welfare for decades and how we stand with those. So we want to talk about that a little bit.
Yes, Mr. Chairs. In fact, Oregon's standards are very close to the national standards in terms of caseloads in child abuse neglect assessment, in terms of ongoing cases in child protective services, and we are doing very well in the foster care caseload arena because we've been able to curtail the number of children entering foster care. We've been able to safely keep kids at home rather than putting kids in care. The one area that we are a little bit different is our supervisor to worker ratio is established by the legislature, and that is one supervisor to 9.5 staff members. A national standard would be about 1.7 if you have experienced staff and 1.5 if you have inexperienced caseworkers. But we are working on this issue because as part of our reorganization, we are actually trying to look at, does every person being supervised by a child welfare supervisor actually require that supervision, or are some of those business functions and some of those could be teased out and moved on to another place? Because in child welfare, we do what we call clinical supervision. There's much more activity around knowing exactly what's happening in a case versus simply supervising a business function in an office. But we're not that far off as a state. We're not that far off from what Child Welfare League of America sets as national standards.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Ackerman has a question.
Yes, I was just curious if in your investigation of the Pond case that you have the opportunity to pull other files to determine whether you have a pattern, administrative pattern of failure here, or whether the Pond situation is an isolated incident.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, I think that we have had an opportunity to look at different scenarios in Clackamas County. We didn't take a sampling of the files, but from talking with the staff and talking with the supervisors there, it's clear that we were lax on our standards, that we weren't reviewing the cases within 5 days. We weren't making immediate referrals to law enforcement. So this was not isolated in Clackamas. And the question then for me is that happening in other branches as well? And that's why we're doing those reviews.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Mink, I'm curious in that situation then, you're saying, did they give a reason? I mean, was it the case load, overload, or what was their reason for?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan, I think workload is always what people talk about. But here's the thing.
Excuse too.
Yes. Yeah. Workload's always an issue, I think, that people talk about. And when you look at the Pond case, that morning when we got the referral in, there were 35 referrals total that came in that day. And the particular screener that got this case had 11 cases total, 10 other ones. And we don't know how difficult those cases were and the complexity of those. So workload is an issue, but one of the things that I think is true is that if you're backlogged, let's say a month on your review of a worker's work, once you get caught up, it shouldn't be any more work. And so we're aggressively working with Bill and others about what do we need to do to make sure our workers are doing the screenings within 5 days. How do we catch up if we're behind? And then the supervisor reviews, how do you catch up if you're behind, and then maintain it? Because once you drop behind, that's going to become your standard. We got to keep the standard what the statutory standard is. And as Ramona said, our caseload standards here in Oregon aren't out of the realm when you look at national experts. The way we do things here and our systems aren't the same as other states, and so I want to have a look at how we can make our systems more efficient and how we can make our workers more efficient and all of that before I agree that it's all workload.
Mr. Chair, the reason I asked the question, you know, I know some of the people who had those systems, and, you know, they're, I think, competent professional people who don't just say, don't bother with it. So it's not an attitude kind of a thing. That's why I was curious what you were finding as the reason behind it.
Yeah. Well, this, Ms. Chair and Senator Duncan, this system in Oregon's grown up over the last 30 years to be something different than it is in other states. In other states, as an example, for a number of years, they've been having 24-hour turnaround on these referrals, and yet we're at 5 days, and we're working now. Bill and Ramona are working so that we can get to that 24-hour turnaround on our screens.
Feel free to continue.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to summarize with you what we did in Clackamas. I think I've done that. And also to give you notice that we're doing three other reviews of the system and offer to come back when we get those done to give you a report on what we've got there. And that was what I was going to accomplish today. So we're open to any questions.
Okay, that's great. Yes, Senator Burdick.
Thank you. In your reviews, in your reviews, are you also going to look into the aspect of this that was very troubling to me, at least in the prosecution sense, that the fact that this child had been had multiple reports of abuse from multiple sources, it actually, when it got in the criminal justice system, that seemed to work against her. And are you covering this area to make sure that that does not permeate your agency, where multiple charges might actually work against the credibility of a child?
Yeah, well, what's the child welfare expert talking about?
Mr. That. Chair and Senator Burdick, absolutely. One of the concerns that we have is, in Oregon, there's a history that we collect reports, and there may be multiple reports on children, as opposed to where we want to go, and that is the first report is the one that we need to be responding to first. Other reports may actually present evidence or other collateral contacts. But one of the things, as we look at this situation in Oregon City, is I have several times publicly expressed concerns about teenagers and making sure that as we assess risk, that we are training our staff to assess risk with teenagers, which can be different in terms of how you look at the allegations around a 13 or a 16-year-old versus the allegations of a 3-year-old. And this is part of what we've referenced when we talk about the 24-hour response that we want to move to in this state. The 24-hour response would actually contemplate that a worker has to know all of the levels of risk to any child all the way up to the age of 18. That'll be a huge shift for us in practice because we've not traditionally had the same level of attention given to teenagers as we have given to younger children. And I think this case is, without going into the details of the case, is a good example of us to be able to look at how are we treating adolescents and teens who get reported to our systems.
Senator, yeah.
Oh, I was going to kind of add this little comment and respond. My experience, again, is that Oregon, even with all of the problems that we're talking about here, is a national leader in this area, which is the one of the – if you hear me talk on this issue, you'll oftentimes see tears start welling up in my eyes both, because I can't stop doing that because it becomes a hard issue with you. And that was in my experience as a detective doing these investigations. The thing that just struck me – was, you know, San Diego, California, Dallas, Texas, Denver, Colorado, Portland, Oregon. You know, there may be one or two others, national leaders in this whole area of having this ongoing multidisciplinary dialogue between the various participants where people can have access. And when you see the problems that we're discussing today, it just shows you, you know, the thumbnail sketch of the problem that we're really dealing with. And it's a much broader and larger problem than just this particular case. But it's one that I think compels continued dialogue and not a lot of finger pointing. That's why I'm not coming after you guys and saying you're the problem, because I know that's not true. We need to continue this legislature and future legislature need to continue the dialogue in a way that helps bring the partners together so that we can do a better job. Just a little caveat, since 1993, the Oregon penitentiary system right now, 11,000 inmates, over one-third of the inmates are convicted sex offenders. The vast majority of the victims in those cases are children since 1993. So keep that in mind. We're filling up the prison systems with individuals who are abusing sexually and physically children. So this legislation, I've said this in numerous committee meetings and to numerous people before, it is a huge problem that not just Oregon, but other states are going to be facing as we progress in this public policy area. So.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Sherrilyn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mink or Ms. Foley, on page 8 of the report, this kind of gets back again to exactly what level of initial evaluation occurs at the SCF stage of receiving the report and what kind of discretion or evaluation goes on in determining whether to refer a report on to law enforcement for investigation. But there's, for the bottom of the page, 2A, you refer to it as the 1997 protocol for handling abuse reports, and it says, SCF shall receive and screen all reports then under that says, one, an SCF screener will collect data for the initial report. Two, an SCF screener will assess the degree of risk to the child, determine the need for SCF intervention, and immediately advise law enforcement. That's not clear to me. Does that immediately advise law enforcement apply in all cases? The conjunctive there suggests that it does, but what's the role in assessing the degree of risk to the child then? If tell me how that works. It's not clear the way that's written.
Mr. Chairs and Representative Shetterly, DHS does, in fact, screen the reports. Now, we get about 36,000 reports a year. About half of those will require some type of an assessment, because some of those, and kind of the standard overall, is if what is being alleged is true, this would constitute abuse and neglect, according to Oregon statute. So out the door at the front end are screened out those things that would not constitute abuse and neglect. And then our interpretation is that if we screen this report in, saying there will be an assessment, then the law requires that we immediately advise law enforcement. What we have found in looking at this over the last several weeks is the term immediately is defined differently as you travel around the state. And to the point of the importance of the MDTs, the multidisciplinary teams, some of those teams have defined for their own community how quickly this advising law enforcement will happen. And so we do have some variation there. The variation is not a bad thing. As Senator Menes says, we want communities to be able to make this process work. For us right now, what we're trying to do is go to a standard where our staff don't question how soon they have to get something to law enforcement. But we are also still respectful of the role of the MDT. And since we have a temporary rule out, this is not permanent rule, it's temporary rule, we're hoping for input, and I think Mr. Fink is gathering input from around the state about how this seems to be working at the local level. But yes, this would contemplate that all those things that we're going to be assessing would in fact become known to law enforcement, even if there was no relationship for law enforcement in terms of the criminal investigation.
And follow up on that.
Follow up.
And then, I guess, getting back to the question I asked earlier about third-party abuse, in this review, are you contemplating a different protocol for third-party abuse if it arises to the level of criminal child abuse? Does it go, whether it's third-party or family?
Mr. Chairs and Representative Shetterly, what we found was that our staff would treat third-party abuse along with other types of familial abuse. So they were doing the screening to check and see, is there an open case? Do we have a history on this family? Are there things that we already know about the family? This, in fact, can be helpful to law enforcement, but can also delay even a third-party abuse report getting over to law enforcement. So what we're asking our staff to do is make the referral over within the time frame that we've designated, the 1 hour, and then continue the work they would be doing anyway. You don't abandon that work. Yep. You will continue because there may be other information helpful to law enforcement, and especially on the third-party abuse cases.
Okay. I would affirm that direction. That sounds good.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Cheryl Walker.
In that same paragraph, the screener will assess the degree of risk. What training do you have for your employees to assess the degree of risk? What, are they trained to do that? Do you have levels? Do you have certain criteria set forth as far as what constitutes degree of risk?
Yes, Mr. Chairs and Representative Walker. All of our screeners are trained, and it's a fairly intensive training in terms of looking at vulnerability of the child, age of the child, what is it being reported, is there a safe caretaker, is this a situation where there is someone who is protecting the child or is the caretaker themselves. All of that is part of several days of training that is provided to all of our staff as screeners. And then that, in addition, if you are the assessor or the investigator, you have additional training to the training of the screeners. Thank you.
Chairman Menes and I have discussed this a little bit ourselves in this report. We really do appreciate you coming in and sharing this with the committee. We've, you know, all of us, I think, have watched, you know, sort of the public discussion as this has occurred as a result of the case. And obviously this reaches several various sort of committee jurisdictional issues within the legislature. But it's our intent, I think, and we'll be anxious to actually have you back to get the update from your statewide report.
Happy to do that.
But we also think that there's probably an appropriate, this is an appropriate point, having talked about, you know, a 10-year approach to the multidisciplinary team, to maybe bring in the other partners in that discussion, the DAs, law enforcement, and others, and to have a more lengthy discussion at the committee level about what we could do to assist all the parties at that level. If there needs to be statutory changes, if there needs to be some direction in defining what immediate really does mean and balancing some of those issues off, to allow a certain amount of triage for the cases that are the difference between a reporting of a head lice case and the reporting of a case of actual sexual abuse by a third party, to do what we need to do to make the system work cleaner and more efficiently and to avoid the kind of situation that eventually developed in Clackamas County. So we do have that intent and interest, I think, as a committee into the next session. And our staff will communicate with you. Obviously, we want to time it. When do you anticipate, Director, that statewide report of those other jurisdictions will be done?
Mr. Chair, it should be done by the middle of November. So,
okay. So we'll be prepared then and early in the session then to maybe have that happen. Mr. Feek, you got off easy. Is there anything you'd like to say?
I did, Mr. Co-Chair. I would just, the only thing I would add is that we have now implemented all of the changes that that Bob mentioned in his press conference earlier in September, and we're in the process of further assessing just how effective the system's working, and we'll bring some of that information back to the committee as well.
Good. Thank you very much. I've still got follow-ups here.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Briefly, this is just maybe a note to Mr. Taylor or to these folks. If we're going to be bringing back other members of the multidisciplinary teams for a discussion about that, one issue that I know I've heard discussed before and that I've had some contact with as a school district attorney is the issue around confidentiality and to what extent that impedes the work of the MDTs, where you have groups at the table who, because of their own statutes, are limited in what they can disclose. To what extent does that hamper the work of the MDT? You've got a school district representative or somebody with medical information or other information at the table but who feels that they can't disclose. I mean, I've heard complaints about that and concerns, and sometimes I think it happens with a wink and a nod when some of this stuff just gets shared because it should. But I'd like to know where we are on that issue of confidentiality at some point, too, on this on the full working of the MDTs.
That's a good issue.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Actually, Representative Sherrill, you raise a very interesting issue because it's one I think the legislature again needs to address to some degree. As an investigator, we've always believed that the confidentiality laws should not be in place or construed to inhibit the ability of law enforcement or responsible agencies to accurately investigate a case of child physical or sexual abuse. But you do run into that roadblock where there's a lack of an understanding with respect to what those laws do or don't do. And I think in one previous session, we provided a good faith inclusion or provision for physicians who would release information, because physicians would not necessarily feel comfortable providing information of medical origin to law enforcement for fear of being sued, and rightfully so, because they're sued on a regular basis. Where I come into problems that needs to be addressed is where federal confidentiality laws,
student records.
Right. My conversations in a previous case with the U.S. Attorney's Office is such that they agree, by and large, that those confidentiality laws are not constructed and do not inhibit investigation of child abuse cases. However, agencies that deal with medical, drug and alcohol treatment programs, et cetera, again, will refuse access or refuse access to medical information or even their premises from time to time. Even if the case is a hot case, something that requires immediate response, they simply will stonewall you and you end up having to do a search warrant to go get your stuff. So in any event, that is it's a troubling area.
Representative Ackerman?
Yes, my quick read of the statute would indicate that our public schools should report abusive behavior to your agency. I need to know whether that is really done in fact, or whether you find that our schools tend to handle these matters internally. And probably another question would be, if that's true, is that an adequate way to handle this, or should we require that the school districts do their own screening and report directly to law enforcement personnel, thereby reducing some of your caseload?
Mr. Chairs and Representative Ackerman, we do get a lot of reports from the school system. I think the law, as I recall, says that a school personnel has to either report or cause a report to be made. That, again, is a little bit unique in Oregon because it does allow that individual, a teacher, whomever, to report perhaps to a principal. So it doesn't, there could be an internal process, but ultimately the law rests on the concept that the report does get over to child welfare. Again, I think as we look at the role of the MDTs, there is potential there to look to see, is that the kind of conversation that at the MDT level, there could be some clarification as to how that report gets handled, whether or not it's third-party abuse or whether or not it's a child for whom we think that the parent is the abuser. I think that kind of clarification at MDT would be very helpful to us.
Yes, Council Taylor.
Representative Williams, members of the committee, the child abuse reporting laws, I remember correctly, there are a whole series of professions that are required to report, teachers among them, law enforcement, lawyers, doctors, et cetera. The only professions that I remember that have any qualifications on them, where they don't necessarily have to report under certain circumstances, a clergy or some of the clergy penance and privilege, or attorneys where it's either a secret or it's given as part of the confidential communication. The rest of them all have to report. So, for example, if the teacher knows about child abuse, they have a responsibility on their own and to their own professional record to report to your organization. And it's not sufficient if they simply report to the principal of the school.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Duncan.
I'm reminded that a number of years ago, when the law first came into play, the superintendent of schools in Eugene, maybe Representative Ackerman remembers this, but the superintendent was brought up on charges for the teacher. I don't remember the full case, but I mean, there was a reporting within the district, but it didn't get through, and so the superintendent was held liable at that particular point. And there was criminal charges against him, I believe. But I just bring it to your attention. You might want to look back and see how that relationship works, because it was, in fact, he's the superintendent of schools in Boston today, but it was the Eugene superintendent at that time.
One of the things that, and perhaps when the time comes in the beginning of the next session, you can help us out, but I frankly think that it might be worthwhile, and we've done this obviously with law enforcement and with the corrections folks, but it might be worth our while, actually, to take a little field trip as a committee to, you know, maybe your Marion County operation and actually have you walk us through the process. You know, this is the desk. This is how the phone calls come in. This is the report the person fills out. They hand it to this person. I mean, sometimes that visual experience of sort of walking through your operation and seeing the kind of, I mean, we can sort of all imagine, but I think until we've actually seen it, it might be a worthwhile thing for us to do as well. So that's something that we can talk about as a committee and determine whether people are interested in that, but I'm sure you'll accommodate us.
You bet. We'd be happy to set that up.
Wanted to make that visit. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony and your time this morning. Our next panel is going to focus on the Mental Health Alignment Work Group and that report. Okay. So do people know who's going to come on? Okay, so we're going to have in this next panel, if they'd come up, please, Bob Nickel, the Deputy Assistant Administrator for DHS Office of Mental Health Services. I don't even know if you can fit that on a business card, can you? Madeline Olson, the Assistant Administrator, and Sheriff John O'Brien from Lincoln County.
Thank you.
Okay. If we're going to have a little, time to set up the PowerPoint presentation, then why don't we do a five-minute refresh your coffee and use the restroom, and we'll start promptly at 9:18.